Hi, everyone. I'm an alcoholic. My name is James McElwee. My friends call me Jimmy Mac. And it's an honor and privilege to speak in an AA meeting. And I want to thank Larry and Colleen for inviting me to come here tonight and share my story. I was taught that we share what it was like, what I was like, what happened to me as a result of this program, and what I'm like today. And hopefully you'll hear something in that message that gives you some encouragement and some hope that you don't have to live the way that you lived before. You don't have to drink, and your life will change dramatically for the better. I know it has for me. I like that you read how more about alcoholism. Every time I hear that reading, it makes me laugh, especially when it gets to the part for like men who have lost their legs. It reminds me of a Far Side cartoon I used to get, and there's a picture of Joe's Frog Farm, and it shows all these frogs hopping in on one side, and then on the exit door, they're coming out with a crutch and one leg, because frogs grow their legs back. You know, if they lose a leg, they can grow it back. I always wanted to be a frog. You know, I was I'm a native, second-generation native San Diego. I was born and raised about 3 miles from here. My parents died in the house I was born in. This is my old stomping grounds. I did a lot of boozing and carousing in this neighborhood. And I'm going to start at the beginning, you know. I was born. I was born at 12:05 in the afternoon, thirsty. And my family was a large Irish Catholic, Scotch-Irish Catholic family. There was eight of us in a 950-square-foot, two-bedroom, one-bath house, four girls and two boys, and I was angry. I had to share everything. Never had anything, never had any privacy. I was really upset when the third child, my sister Janet, was born. Because then I knew that we were going on a downhill slide quick. And my parents were very poor. My dad had worked two jobs trying to support the family. He never really had a job that paid much, so he was always gone. And I later hated my dad for that because he was never there. And, you know, we got by. My parents felt the best they could do for us is to send us to Catholic school because if we got a good education, it would be a good head up in life, that we'd be able to do something or accomplish what they were unable to. And so they would save their money, and they put all six kids through Holy Spirit Catholic school. It's 55th and Bullock. And, you know, the Sisters of Mercy, Lord have mercy. They were brutal. I still hold the record at Holy Spirit for the most rulers broken over knuckles. 2 years I sat next to the teacher's desk. They didn't let me out in the general public because I was too disruptive in class. And Mother Mercedes, she was the Mercedes of mothers, let me tell you. Stood about 5'2". She was the meanest woman you'd ever want to confront. And you know, I used to blame all that on my drinking. You know, if you came from my family, if you came from my upbringing, if you had to go to Holy Spirit Catholic school and bear the humiliation from those Irish nuns, you would drink too. And the bottom line is nothing of that stuff that ever happened made me an alcoholic. But what made me an alcoholic was the first time I put alcohol into my system, my life changed. And that was in 1963. I was 13 years old. It was a brutal year. I watched JFK get assassinated in my eighth grade class with Sister Mary Celestine. He was the first Irish Catholic president, so anything dealing with JFK, we watched on, you know, the Irish nuns watched. They loved John Kennedy, so we watched on television. So I watched Kennedy get assassinated live. A month later, my grandfather died, and my grandfather was kind of someone I was taught to revere and look up to. I'd ride my 10-speed bike down to National City every Saturday and wash his car. And when he died, so both of those things were horrific things to happen to a 13-year-old child. But neither one of those things made me an alcoholic. But in December, I was sent to chaperone my older sister, Mary. Her boyfriend was playing in a band at a little park on Colina del Sol, CYO, Catholic Youth Organization dance. And Jose Medina and I decided we were going to get drunk that night. And I drank two tall Colt 45s and my world went from black and white to Technicolor. You know, all that, because I came from a poor family, I always felt less than and not part of. I always felt a little bit weird and a little bit different. I know none of you in this room ever had that feeling. Can't relate to that at all. But when I drank that alcohol, something magical happened. You know, I left that dance 3 hours later. The crotch of my pants split out, soaking wet. I had a girlfriend. You know, all the stuff that I wanted but never felt confident enough to accomplish, I accomplished that night. And I went, this has got to be what heaven's all about. So from then on, I drank at every opportunity. And at age 17, I was kicked out of my house because I was a bad influence to my brothers and sisters. And at age 17, I became a daily drinker. And because I was a blackout drinker, I found that if I did a cellarance, I could drink like the big boys. So part of my story involves drugs, lots of them. But I only did them once from 1965 until 1993. Anyhow, I was brought up in the 60s, so, you know, if it felt good, do it. And we did everything. You know, alcohol worked for me for a long time. You know, I wasn't unpopular in school. I was voted bluest eyes, ninth grade at Horseman when I went to public school. I was sweetheart of the month in the Cougar magazine. I was a cheerleader in high school. I was the mascot for Crawford High School. I was the Colt. And so it wasn't like I was weird or ostracized from society in school. I was pretty popular. Had a lot of pretty girlfriends, so I didn't have that going on. Even though I had all that stuff, I still didn't feel right inside. And alcohol always balanced that out. Gave me that false bravado to carry on and do the next thing. Because I didn't have the confidence by myself to do that. And my first wife got pregnant when I was 19. And my daughter Natalie was born when I was 20 years old. And I started my own business, my first business at that point in time. I drank and did drugs every day, but had my little carpet cleaning business and worked at Standard Brands Paint during the day and bought my first house up by College Avenue and figured life was pretty good. My son John was born 2.5 years later, and 6 months after John was born, my wife gave me an ultimatum. She said, "You need to quit drinking and doing drugs or else I'm going to leave you, because I can't live like this and I'm not going to subject my kids to this kind of behavior." Because all that anger for all the stuff that I didn't have, I'd bring home and I'd take it out on the kids. Not physically. I wasn't physically abusive or verbally. I just wasn't available. I would be checked out. And my wife wanted more. And I wasn't able to deliver that. So at age 23, I was given the ultimatum. I said, "I'll take the car and the stereo." And I left and signed a quitclaim deed of the house over to her. And in 1973, the disco scene was just happening in San Diego. And I was off and running. And we had a little booger sugar that came around at that time, so there was some different accelerants that were available to help you get through the night. And so I loved to dance. I became a disco model. I modeled at the Oz and the Odyssey. I had an afro, a Fu Manchu, 3-inch platform shoes, skinny as a rail from doing all that booger sugar. But I had my Angel Flights, my Dow Manual signature polyester shirts that make you, if you didn't wear enough cologne, it'd make you stink like hell by the end of the night. And man, I had it going on. That was the deal. Every night I would do that. And every Wednesday and Thursday morning after I'd do my gig, I'd wake up and the front of my shirt would be covered with red sauce. I always stop at Roberto's. I lived in OB at the time and grab some chicken enchiladas to come down so I could go to work the next morning. And that's what I did every day. Every day. Got drunk, got tanked, woke up, go to work. And because I was functioning, I didn't think I had a problem. I wasn't an alcoholic. I couldn't be an alcoholic. I wasn't pushing a shopping cart. I wasn't living underneath a bridge. See, because one of the things that my parents instilled with me is a sense of responsibility. And so, you know, I had to afford my booze. So I had to work. You know, I wasn't a thief. My parents cured me of that when I was 5 years old. I was walking home from school, and we had this little store called Kip's Variety. And we couldn't afford to have candy. That's when they still had penny candy, by the way. And so I was walking home with my sister, and we stopped into Kipp's and had a couple of pennies, bought some Bazooka bubble gum, and I used to love Necco wafers, so I stole a pack of Necco wafers. And we were walking up the street of Redwood, and my sister asked for some, and I wouldn't share them with her.
I'm going to tell Mom.
So, sure enough, we got home. She told Mom. So, Mom marched me down to Kipp's Variety and made me fess up to it, paid for the candy, and that cured my stealing. But I stole other things. I stole from you. I stole, you know, I used to brag that I never killed anybody physically. I killed a lot of people emotionally from the hurtful things that I would do and the way that I'd treat people. And that happens with a lot of us. We don't think about the feelings or the emotions or how we treat other people. We're concerned about ourselves and getting ours, or at least I was. I don't think I'm terminally unique in that regard as it relates to alcoholics. I think they were all a little bit selfish and self-centered. And so, fast forward, you know, I continued on that path. I met my second wife in 81 and just fell in love with her. She was such a sweet lady. And I was still doing that booger sugar at the time. She told me that she wouldn't marry me if I was still doing that, so I quit doing that, and I started doing another substance because I couldn't drink. Just if I drank, I got sloppy. And so I had to have some kind of a stimulant in me so I could drink like big people. I didn't like slurring my words or being sloppy, so I always did speed. So I started doing crystal in my coffee, 5:30 in the morning, and so that my wife would know that I was still getting loaded. And so we got married, had two kids, two beautiful boys, Brian and Timmy. 1993, almost 20 years to the date, I have a wife, two kids, and I'm given the same ultimatum. Either stop drinking and doing drugs or I'm divorcing you. I'm not going to live this way. I'm not going to subject my kids to this kind of behavior. You need to do something about your problem. Fear of losing my stuff kept me in that relationship. I did not love my wife at that moment. She was taking away the only thing that ever worked that made me feel normal. Even though the last 7 years of my drinking, I was miserable. Every day I would swear to myself, I'm not going to do this. And every day I was powerless about doing anything about it. Every day I'd wake up and say, I'm not going to drink anymore. And I couldn't stop from getting drunk. I remember I was going to prove myself. I was going to prove to my wife one time that I could quit drinking any time. This was on a Monday morning. So I said, I'm not going to drink today. So I didn't put the stuff in my coffee that morning. 10 o'clock, I was just shaking. And so I said, I'll just have a beer. And then, as all alcoholics do, once you have one, well, what's the point? You know, tomorrow's a new day. I couldn't even make it one day. And I gave up on that experiment. It was just a dismal failure. So I continued drinking, and I drank myself to sleep every night. And every morning I'd wake up feeling shame, guilt, disgusted with myself, and powerless over doing anything about it. I had lost the choice. I had lost any control over anything in my life. Alcohol had me. It had become my master. What had once been my solution was now the problem. And there was nothing I could do, and I was too proud and too stupid to say that I had a problem. I need help. So when my wife gave me that ultimatum, it was a gift from God. The fear of losing my stuff was another gift from God. Sometimes fear has a good effect. It kept me in that relationship. It got me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And though I didn't practice these principles the first year I was in here, which I do not recommend. By the way, welcome to the newcomers and first-timers and people that have been here for a while that maybe are struggling with their sobriety, because I want you to know that you're not alone. But there's a room of people that have, group of people that have gone through that. And what happened was, after the end of that first year, I realized I wasn't going to get my diploma from AA, because I really was convinced at the end of 1 year I'd be able to get out and drink like a gentleman. And then when I didn't get that, we were at a couples meeting. My wife, the only place my wife felt safe to communicate was a couples group we'd go to every Saturday night, because it wasn't safe to talk at home because I was just too angry. And so we'd go to our couples group, and we were coming back, and one of the people in the group had relapsed. And uh, and Mary had taken him back, and everything was hunky-dory. And so I was talking, this was about when I was about 1 year sober. So on the way back from our meeting, I told her, I said, you know, if I relapse, it wouldn't be that big of a deal, right? You'd be okay with that. She goes, absolutely not. If you relapse, you're out of here. And I felt like saying, you intolerant, fill in the blank. And we got a big argument over that. You know, where's your acceptance and approval? Where's your love? Where's your Al-Anon program? Don't pull that stuff here, mister. So she had a pretty strong program. By the way, Julie, when we read the chapter on acceptance, it was on page 448 when I got sober in the third edition. They changed it in the fourth edition. Dr. Paul, my wife and I used to go to a retreat up at Lake Arrowhead. It was a communication workshop that was put on by Paul and Max. And when Paul would share his story, it was verbatim from that book. It was that chapter. And Max would give as good as she got. She'd always share after Paul, and she'd come up and just give it back to him like nobody's business. And what they did is they always had their hand out to new couples that would come up to that couples group. And they were always there to support and lift them up. And it was, what an inspiration to have met them and gone to that workshop when they were both still alive, because they really practiced this principle. They were really concerned about helping the alcoholic and helping couples. Because a lot, when I came into the program, most of the people that were in here, they were in relationships, were either headed for a divorce, in a divorce, or there wasn't a lot of hope for couples. I didn't see much anyway. And they, they showed us the way as a couple that there was hope in the relationship for couples in recovery. So let me fast forward. That's kind of, I could go on. I don't remember a lot of my drunk log because I was a blackout drinker. Most of it was hearsay, so I don't want to spread false rumors. Anyhow, I want to tell you more about what happened to me as a result of this program. When I finally got the fact that I had to do things differently, that nothing was going to change my life until I changed, I couldn't expect things to just happen. It actually required, alcoholics, AA stands for attitude and action. It's a program of action, rigorous action. And so for me, until I got hooked up with a sponsor, the first sponsor I chose was one out of convenience because I knew that he was a pushover. I could tell him anything and he wouldn't really make me do anything. And that did not work too well for me or him. But it was convenient because I had a sponsor. I could say I had a sponsor. I had a sponsor in name only. The second sponsor I got me involved in service. He got me involved with the Spring Roundup. And that was the best thing he did for me, is he got me active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But at 10 years, he decided he didn't need AA anymore, so he quit going. And that's when I was about 5 years sober, and at that point, my bottom was falling off. Even though I'd been in the program 5 years, not much had changed in my behavior. I was still, when I first came in the program, when you see here a lot of people talk about, what do you get when you sober up a drunken horse thief? A horse thief, right? Well, if that's all there is to recovery, that's not enough. And our job really is to quit stealing horses. You not only have to get sober, but you have to change that behavior. And that's where the steps come into play. And so I hooked up with a man who became my sponsor, my spiritual advisor, my best friend. His name is Peter Fleischman. He's on the big meeting in the sky right now. And he walked me through the big book and walked me through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and taught me everything that I know today and set me on a course of rigorous action that has absolutely transformed and changed my life. And the first thing he did when I asked him to be my sponsor, he says, we need to get busy. And the first thing we did is we started on the first page of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first page is blank. That's about all I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous when I came in at 5 years. I'd been a poser. I looked good in the rooms. It was easy for me to go to a meeting, and I knew what lines to quote to say, oh, boo-boo, I really loved your share, and get the attaboys and the pats on the back. But I was a taker. I wasn't contributing anything back to the program. And Peter said the first thing you have to do is you have to start changing your attitude. You have to start practicing these principles. It's not what you're getting, it's what you're giving that's important. And I told him, well, I'm confused. I don't know how to do this spiritual thing. I got the fact that I'm powerless over alcohol, but I don't know about this God stuff. And he said, this is a spiritual program. Unless you find a connection with a higher power, a power that you can do business with, your chances of staying sober are precarious at best. Chances are you might stay sober, but you're going to be pretty miserable in the process. And I said, well, what does that look like? And he said, well, I'm going to tell you what it looks like. You know, a spiritual act, you know, a lot of us get kind of mystified by spirituality. What does that look like? What is spirituality? You know, what is it? You know, what is God? What is this nebulous higher power? And I was told in real simple terms what a spiritual program of action was all about. Putting the cart back in the cart barn at the grocery store. Being where you say you're going to be when you say you're going to be there. Doing what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. Speaking kindly about people, never speaking harshly about somebody. Not participating in malicious gossip. You know, these are all spiritual acts. More importantly, you know, the essence of this program is we learn that to treat other people like we want to be treated. The golden rule. You know, if you're treating somebody like you want to be treated, you're not going to do anything harmful to them. Unless you're a masochist and you like abuse. Right? And so what helps us get there is there's a set of simple instructions. It's called the 12 Steps. It's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. When practiced on a daily basis, will assure that you will stay on that spiritual path. So for me, step two, you know, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. You know, I found that higher power. I was finally able to get humble enough to admit that I wasn't it and that I needed help. Step three, I accepted that higher power in my life. And I turned my life and my will over to His care and protection. And I was taught that each one of these steps cements itself to the next one. The way you do step two is by doing step three. The way you do step three is by doing step four. You know, you do that searching, fearless moral inventory of yourself. And during that process, when you're doing that, if you've been fearless and thorough, omitting nothing, you've discovered some pretty gruesome facts about yourself and your behaviors. And only when you discover that stuff can you do anything about it. And this program of recovery is a process of uncovering, discovering, and discarding old behaviors. So until I actually put pen to paper, you know, I could rationalize stuff up here all day long. I could come up with 1,000 different excuses why I acted a certain way and justify them. But when I put pen to paper, something miraculous happened. It connected this to this. It connected my head to my heart. I could see clearly what my behavior was, and then I could see clearly what the next course of action was necessary for me to correct that behavior. That's called an inventory. And, you know, solitary self-appraisal avails us nothing. You know, until I shared that with God and another human being, it really didn't have much weight. It didn't have much gravity. When I shared that with my sponsor and was honest with him, at first I kind of followed the format in the big book. There's an outline in there. It's not that difficult to do. But my fourth column was kind of fluffy and airy and not too real. And he stopped me about item number two. He said, nah, this isn't going to work. We need to look at this from the standpoint of the seven deadly sins. Where have you been greedy, lustful, angry? Where have you been miserly? Where have you been, and we looked at it from that gluttonous, slothful, which is procrastination, you know. And so I took a look at it from that standpoint, and I could see clearly the pattern. You know, I used to think I had some resentments for people with all the wonderful things I did for them, and they treated me terribly. And I used to think that that was a justifiable resentment. And it was pointed out to me that all that stuff I did for them, I always had a hook attached to it. I always had an expectation that one day that there would be a margin call and they'd pay me back for that stuff. You know, I never really gave freely of anything. I had to take a look at that behavior. You know, it wasn't pretty to see. You know, I thought I was pretty clean on a lot of that stuff, and I wasn't. And it was ugly, and I had to correct some of that behavior. It was painful. It was painful to look at that. He had some stuff that he wiped clean. He said, you owe amends for that. You know, that you truly, you know, I had some stuff happen in my childhood that he absolved me from and said, you don't owe amends for that. You know, you were taken advantage of. It wasn't right. And I'm so grateful that he walked me through that process. And then it comes down to the hard part. You know, we have steps 6 and 7. Humbly ask and remove our shortcomings, you know. Ask them to take away these character defects, your higher power. That's where the rubber meets the road. In the big book, there's only 2 paragraphs on those 2 steps. And in the 12 and 12, on step 6, it says, this is the step that separates the men from the boys. That has a little more gravity to it than the big book. Because that's where you've identified those things that are egregious, the behaviors that you have. And that's where you stop stealing horses. That's when you start changing your behaviors. And it, for me, it's been, you know, as a spiritual appendix in the back of the book, it talks about most of us don't have that blinding light religious experience like Bill had. Most of us, our religious experience happens slowly over a long period of time. And for me, that's how my sobriety's been. It's happened slowly over a long period of time. You know, I'm kind of a slow learner. I didn't get all this stuff at once. And I've had a lot of painful things happen to me in sobriety. Some of those behaviors I did when I was out there, I was doing when I was sober. And when it finally caught up to me and I had to take an honest look at that, only then could I change, and it became painful enough for me to do something different. Only then was I willing to do something different. You know, for me, I have to get in some pain over it. You know, I don't learn when things are going well. I don't take directions well. I don't play well with others. I never went to preschool, okay? So for me, in order for it to have weight and gravity, there has to be a lesson in it. My lessons have usually been painful. And I'm so grateful for those. My sponsor used to always tell me, thank God for the seemingly bad thing that turned out to be the seemingly good thing. And he said, I wish for you great pain and suffering. And I said, what kind of a deal is that? You're supposed to be my aide, my helper, my spiritual mentor and advisor. And he said, Jan, you're too selfish and self-centered to get it any other way. And until you get real, and you know, you're going to have some painful experiences to go through. And I certainly have. And I'm so grateful for those today. You know, I wasn't grateful when I was going through them. I didn't want to look at them. I didn't want to look at my part. You know, and I always had a part in it. It was easy for me to assign responsibility or blame somewhere else than it was to take a look at what I had to do. And but I do that today. You know, I look at things honestly and openly. The last couple of years have been kind of difficult business-wise. I had to cash in some of my life insurance policies and stuff to keep my business afloat. I wanted to blame our president. I wanted to blame anybody but me for my sloth and procrastination. And I was talking with my wife, 6 months ago. Had a couple of really bad things happen. Not so bad. They're not bad now, but I mean, at the time, they seemed catastrophic. And I told her, I said, I don't know what to do anymore. I'm just done. I got really angry with God. We were coming back from her parents' house in Santa Barbara. We got down to Highway 78. We usually cut across because we live up in Alpine. Cut across and take 67, the back route to Alpine. And she noticed that there had been a change in my demeanor coming down. And I'd gotten a text message about something that happened in business that really upset me. And she goes, what's wrong? What's going on? And I just exploded. I just went, I am so angry. I'm angry with God. I'm just mad. I've tried to live my life good. I've tried to practice these principles in all my affairs. I've tried to do the right thing. And I just keep getting screwed. I'm so tired of getting screwed. I'm done. I wanted to quit. I didn't want to drink. The thought of drinking didn't enter my mind. The thought of quitting did. And I said, I pray every day for God's will for me and the power to carry that out. And I just don't know what it is anymore. What does he want from me? I just can't do this anymore. It's just getting too hard. And she said, maybe his will for you is to make sure that the 75 people that work for you are making their payments and getting their paychecks and that they're surviving. And maybe you need to re-examine your role. And I had to take a look at that. You know, where had I been greedy? Where had I been selfish? I had to take a look at my behavior once more. And I didn't want to do that. And so what I decided to do at that point in time is, you know, we have a solution. The book gives us answers to everything. Every one of my problems is answered in the big book. And it's as simple as turning it over. You know, every day I have a choice. I can turn it over to my higher power. Or I can hold on to that towel. I can give him the towel, or I can hang on to it and go for the ride. And what I decided to do at that point in time was turn my business over to God. Do a third step on my business. You know, the big book talks about God's the director. You know, he's the father, we're the kids. It says that in the big book. Do I really believe that, or am I just giving that verbiage? You know, it also says that faith without works is dead. You know, I have to have faith that if God brings me to it, he'll get me through it. And I wasn't really living in faith. I was living in denial. I was living in the fact that I wasn't doing everything I could. I was being slothful once again. My old behaviors had caught up with me, but I wanted to justify and rationalize those things away. So I gave my business over to God. I now work for God. He owns the business. And since I've done that, things are going much better. That simple surrender. You know. In the second edition, before the third edition came out, there was a chapter in the book. It was called The Professor and the Paradox. You can still find that in some place at Central Office. I think they have some copies of that. And it talks about the paradox that is Alcoholics Anonymous. A paradox is when the opposite appears to be real, the opposite of what your belief is. So we have a few sayings in here. One is surrender to win. When I used to think of surrender to win, when I'm surrendering, I'm not winning anything. That means I've given up. But what I've learned today is that when I surrender, it empowers me. It's really a powerful deal. Because when I let go and I drop that rock, I can see clearly what action I need to take to get through it. I can't see that when I'm holding on to it. When I surrender, I get the freedom to make the right decision. And with God's help, I can make the right decision and take the right action. I can't do that on my own. The other thing is we've got to pass it on to keep it. We've got to give it away to keep it. One of the other great paradoxes of this program. The only way I get to keep my sobriety today is if I'm willing to give it all away. And we do that in the form of helping another alcoholic. By extending our hand out when somebody's suffering and listening to them. Sharing our experience, strength, and hope. Because, you see, I believe that we're all shot through with we're all cut from the same cloth. We have the same common ailments. Hugh McCoy, who was kind of an early mentor of mine, he was one of the pioneers of AA here in San Diego. When I first got sober, he was the anchor in my home group, La Mesa Men's. He used to always say that if we all wrote down our story on a piece of paper, room full of people, if y'all wrote down your story and we flew them up in the air, you could pick up any one of those pieces of paper and you could read your story. And I believe that's true. It doesn't matter if you're man, woman, black, white, pink, purple, gay, straight, married, single. You know, we all have the same. We all suffer from a spiritual malady, a twofold illness. We suffer from an allergy and an obsession. And what brings us to that is usually the same stuff. You know, we all feel a little bit different, a little bit weird. We drank because we liked the effect produced by alcohol. It gave us that sense of bravado. I mean, we're all shot through. So when you share that solution with someone else, you really help them out. So you give it away to keep it. That's one of the quintessential part of this program. And the other one is by dying, we awaken to eternal life, right? And it doesn't mean dying physically. It means dying from your old ideas. It means being willing to let go of all that old stuff that was really useless and didn't work anyway. You know, the more I let go of stuff that old beliefs that I used to think of, the more freedom I have. And it's kind of exciting. You know, it's kind of exciting to look at life afresh at age 63 and see that I can do things. I don't have to stay stuck in a rut. I can actually explore and do things differently. And it's kind of exciting to see that there's, you know, when I put it out there and stretch myself, I usually get a blessing far greater than I thought I would get. But I got to be willing to do that. I have to take that action. I have to be willing to take the action. Faith without works is dead. So one of the most powerful prayers that we have is in the 11th step prayer, in the 12 and 12, the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi. And for those of you that have any spiritual prejudice, just listen to the words of the prayer when you're reading it and let it sink in. Because what it is, it's a paradoxical prayer. It talks about things that we do to get satisfaction. You know, where there's darkness, may I bring light. Where there's despair, may I bring hope. Lord, grant that I seek to comfort than to be comforted, to forgive than to be forgiven. And all those things are absolutely essential. The more I forgive someone, the more forgiveness I get. The more I try to help my fellow man, the more I'm helped. The less I'm worried about things going on in the world. It just works that way for me. And again, I don't think I'm terminally unique. I think it works that way for everybody if you give it a shot. But you got to do the work. You know, it doesn't happen through osmosis. You don't get it by sitting in a chair in a room with alcoholics. You know, this is a program of action. There's a chapter into action. There's no chapter into thinking, but there is a chapter into action. And it's outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm also one of those people that believes the traditions are as important as the steps. And when they're practiced in your life and your relationship with equal zest and fervor as you do the 12 steps, miraculous things can happen. My wife and I do that. You know, in our relationship, there's but one ultimate authority. I used to think it was King James. And King James got defrocked in 93, so. I used to hear when I first came in that the steps protect me from you, and the traditions protect you from me. You know, they're absolutely essential. And there was a lot of controversy when those were first brought up because there's no rules, right, in AA. And when the traditions were first introduced, there was a lot of people at the first international convention where Bill introduced them. A lot of the old-timers didn't want anything to do with it. So he kind of put it through proxy. They had a steering committee meeting that nobody showed up for, and they railroaded through those traditions, and they became a foundation principle of our society today. I'm so glad they're there because we probably wouldn't have AA if we didn't have them. There was too much controversy in too many groups. And so if you're sitting in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous on a Saturday night listening to a 63-year-old babble about his drunken experiences, you probably belong here. There's no doubt in my mind. And my hope for you is that you find what I found in this room, in these rooms, in this program, a design for living that really works. A freedom of bondage, a freedom from bondage of self. I used to be so self-consumed, so self-absorbed, I couldn't help anybody. And today, I can actually think of somebody else's feelings and their best interests before mine. And that is a miracle. I'm not a miracle, but this program is. This program has helped hundreds of thousands of people recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And you can recover too. But you got to do the work. Like I said, it's not something that you can just sit in a room and get. I want to go back to that. When I shared about posing the first 5 years, I meant what I said. When I first came into the program, I learned all the quotes that I'd hear people say. And so when I come into the rooms, I'd look good, and I'd get asked to share. I'd go up and I'd share those quotes. I'd come into the meeting right before it started, and I'd leave right when it ended. I never really contributed, but everybody would always say, "I really loved your share," even at La Mesa Men's. "Oh, I really loved your share." They're all proud and happy. I'd get in the car, and the first off-ramp, I'd cut off the first person, and it just became instant a-hole. Nothing had changed in my life. And today, when I look back on that, I just want to hope for you that you don't have to do that, that you get this program sooner rather than later, that you grab onto somebody that has what you want. You know, today when I look at people that have what I want, I look at people that have that light in their eyes, smile on their face. They have a sense of ease and comfort. They don't seem to be conflicted with anybody or anything. They don't talk bad about their fellow person. They have what I want. They have freedom. They have real freedom. They have joy. They have some happiness. And when they're confronted with sorrow, they realize that it's just a lesson waiting to be learned. They don't combat it and fight it. And that's what I've learned today. Whenever I'm confronted with that seemingly bad thing that turned out to be the seemingly good thing, I embrace it because I know there's always a lesson in that for me. And then I'm the one that benefits when I can surrender that up and look for the lesson. Where was I selfish? Where was whatever the case might be? And so I'm so grateful for a program that saved my life, has given me a relationship with the woman that I love more today than when I first met her, a relationship with my children that I would not have and did not have prior to this program, and a life far beyond my wildest imagination. I want to end with a little story that my sponsor used to always wrap up his pitch with, because I think it's kind of cute and always made me laugh. This drunk dies and he goes to heaven, where he's meted by St. Peter at the pearly gates. He walks up to St. Peter and he goes, 10 minutes. He walks up to St. Peter and he goes, what do I do? And St. Peter says, I don't know. He said, what do you mean you don't know? You're in charge of this thing. And Peter says, not really. He said, but come with me. So he opens up the gates and he walks through. And there's this long aisleway of doors, hundreds of doors. And he says, what we need to do is we need to find a place where you can be happy and spend the rest of your days. I said, okay. So they go to the first door and open it up, and there's people reading out of these psalm books and praying and all sitting in these pews. And he goes, who are they? He goes, those are the Presbyterians, and this is their idea of joy. Oh, no, can't do that. No way. So they walk over to the next door and they open it up. There's people praying on beads fervently, standing up, sitting down, kneeling. He goes, who are these? And he goes, those are the Catholics. This is their idea of joy. Oh, no, no, can't do that one. Sorry, ain't going to work for me. I walk to the third door and there's people with beanies reading out backwards from a scroll. Who are they? Oh, can't do that. Walk to the next one. They're praying on mats, bowing down to these. No, I can't do that. Next one. Goes through all the doors and finally gets to the end and says, there's nothing in here for me. There's nothing here for me. And Peter goes, well, he says, you know, we do have one more. And they walk down the stairs and the bowels of this corridor, and there's one door. And he opens the door, and the first thing he smells is the waft of fresh coffee and stale cigarette smoke. And he peeks inside, and there's people of all shapes and sizes, redheads, brownheads, black, white, yellow, purple. They're all laughing, grabbing ass, having a grand time. And he's going, wow, this is pretty neat. I think I can spend the rest of my time here. And so he starts to go in, and Peter starts to walk away. He says, wait a minute. He says, not that it makes any difference, he says, but who are these people? And Peter turns around and says, you know, that's a strange thing. We don't know, and they won't tell us. But all I want to do is stay one day at a time. God bless you, and God bless Alcoholics Anonymous.
Let's thank Julie and Jemmy once more for taking the time to come to you with us. Our speaker will be available to thank over by the side door after the meeting. If you would like to become a part of this meeting, please come to the business meeting held in the room on the first Saturday of every month at 6:30. If you're interested in taking a commitment at this meeting, please see our secretary, Colleen. Now it's time for her announcement. Come on up.
Hi, everyone. My name is Colleen, and I'm still an alcoholic. And let's thank you once again.